Chapter 15. For 36 hours, Walt Dangerfield had lain on his bunk in a state of semi-consciousness, knowing now that it was not an ulcer. It was cardiac arrest which he was experiencing, and it was probably going to kill him in a very short time, in spite of what Stockstill, the analyst, had said. The transmitter of the satellite had continued to broadcast a tape of light concert music over and over again. The sound of soothing strings filled his ears in a travesty of unavailing comfort. He did not even have the strength to get up and make his way to the controls to shut it off. "That psychoanalyst," he thought bitterly, talking about breathing into a paper bag. It had been like a dream, the faint voice so full of self-confidence, so utterly false in its premises. Messages were arriving from all over the world as the satellite passed through its orbit again and again. His recording equipment caught them and retained them, but that was all. Dangerfield could no longer answer. "I guess I have to tell them," he said to himself. "I guess the time we've been expecting, all of us, has finally come at last." On his hands and knees, he crept until he reached the seat by the microphone, the seat in which for 7 years he had broadcast to the world below. After he had sat there for a time, resting, he turned on one of the many tape recorders, picked up the mic, and began dictating a message which, when it had been completed, would play endlessly, replacing the concert music. "My friends, this is Walt Dangerfield talking, and wanting to thank you for all the times we have had together, speaking back and forth, us all keeping in touch. I'm afraid, though, that this complaint of mine makes it impossible for me to go on any longer. So, with great regret, I've got to sign off for the last time." He went on, painfully, picking his words with care, trying to make them, his audience below, as little unhappy as possible. But, nevertheless, he told them the truth. He told them that it was the end for him, and that they would have to find some way to communicate without him. And then he rang off, shut down the microphone, and, in a weary reflex, played the tape back. The tape was blank. There was nothing on it, although he had talked for almost 15 minutes. Evidently, the equipment had for some reason broken down, but he was too ill to care. He snapped the mic back on, set switches on the control panel, and this time prepared to deliver his message live to the area below. Those people there would just have to pass the word on to the others. There was no other way. "My friends," he began once more, "this is Walt Dangerfield. I have some bad news to give you, but..." And then he realized that he was talking into a dead mic. The loudspeaker above his head had gone silent. Nothing was being transmitted. Otherwise, he would have heard his own voice from the monitoring system. As he sat there, trying to discover what was wrong, he noticed something else, something far stranger and more ominous. Systems on all sides of him were in motion, had been in motion for some time by the looks of them. The high-speed recording and playback decks, which he had never used, all at once the drums were spinning for the first time in 7 years. Even as he watched, he saw relays click on and off. A drum halted, another one began to turn, this time at slow speed. "I don't understand," he said to himself. "What's happening?" Evidently, the systems were receiving at high speed, recording, and now one of them had started to play back. But what had set all this in motion? Not he. Dials showed him that the satellite's transmitter was on the air, and even as he realized that messages which had been picked up and recorded were now being played over the air, he heard the speaker above his head return to life.
"Hooty, hooty, hoo!"
A voice, his voice, chuckled.
"This is your old pal, Walt Dangerfield, once more, and forgive that concert music. Won't be any more of that."
"When did I say that?" he asked himself as he sat dully listening. He felt shocked and puzzled. His voice sounded so vital, so full of good spirits. "How could I sound like that now?" he wondered. "That's the way I used to sound years ago, when I had my health and when she was still alive."
"Well," his voice murmured on, "that bit of indisposition I've been suffering from? Evidently mice got into the supply cupboards, and you'll laugh to think of Walt Dangerfield fending off mice up here in the sky, but 'tis true. Anyhow, part of my store is deteriorated, and I didn't happen to notice, but it sure played havoc with my insides. However,
and he heard himself give his familiar chuckle,
I'm okay now. I know you'll be glad to hear that, all you people down there who were so good as to transmit your get-well messages, and for that I give you thanks.
Getting up from the seat before the microphone, Walt Dangerfield made his way unsteadily to his bunk. He lay down, closing his eyes, and then he thought once more of the pain in his chest and what it meant. Angina pectoris, he thought, is supposed to be more like a great fist pressing down. This is more a burning pain. If I could look at the medical data on the microfilm again, maybe there's some fact I failed to read. For instance, this is directly under the breastbone, not off to the left side. Does that mean anything? Or maybe there's nothing wrong with me, he thought to himself as he struggled to get up once more. Maybe Stockstill, that psychiatrist who wanted me to breathe carbon dioxide, was right. Maybe it's just in my mind, from the years of isolation here. But he did not think so. It felt far too real for that. There was one other fact about his illness that bewildered him. For all his efforts, he could not make a thing out of that fact, and so he had not even bothered to mention it to the several doctors and hospitals below. Now it was too late, because now he was too sick to operate the controls of the transmitter. The pain seemed always to get worse when his satellite was passing over Northern California. In the middle of the night, the din of Bill Keller's agitated murmurings woke his sister up.
"What is it?"
Edie said sleepily, trying to make out what he wanted to tell her. She sat up in her bed now, rubbing her eyes as the murmurings rose to a crescendo.
"Hoppy Harrington," he was saying deep down inside her. "He's taken over the satellite. Hoppy's taken over Dangerfield's satellite."
He chattered on and on excitedly, repeating it again and again.
"How do you know?"
"Because Mr. Bluthgeld says so. He's down below now, but he can still see what's going on above. He can't do anything, and he's mad. He still knows all about us. He hates Hoppy because Hoppy mashed him."
"What about Dangerfield?"
she asked.
"Is he dead yet?"
"He's not down below," her brother said after a long pause. "So I guess not."
"Who should I tell?" Edie said. "About what Hoppy did?"
"Tell Mama," her brother said urgently. "Go right in, now."
Climbing from the bed, Edie scampered to the door and up the hall to their parents' bedroom. She flung the door open, calling,
"Mama, I have to tell you something."
And then her voice failed her, because her mother was not there. Only one sleeping figure lay in the bed, her father, alone. Her mother, she knew instantly and completely, had gone, and she would not be coming back.
"Where is she?" Phil clamored from within her. "I know she's not here. I can't feel her."
Slowly, Edie shut the door of the bedroom. "What'll I do?" she asked herself. She walked aimlessly, shivering from the night cold.
"Be quiet," she said to Bill,
and his murmuring sank down a little.
"You have to find her,"
Bill was saying.
"I can't,"
she said. She knew it was hopeless.
"Let me think what to do instead,"
she said, going back into her bedroom for her robe and slippers. To Ella Hardy, Bonnie said,
"You have a very nice home here. It's strange to be back in Berkeley after so long, though."
She felt overwhelmingly tired.
"I'm going to have to turn in," she said.
It was 2 in the morning. Glancing at Andrew Gill and Stuart, she said,
"We made awfully good time getting here, didn't we? Even a year ago, it would have taken another 3 days."
"Yes," Gill said and yawned. He looked tired, too. He had done most of the driving because it was his horse car they had taken. Mr. Hardy said,
"Along about this time, Mrs. Keller, we generally tune in a very late pass by the satellite."
"Oh,"
she said, not actually caring, but knowing it was inevitable. They would have to listen at least for a few moments to be polite.
"So you get 2 transmissions a day down here?"
"Yes," Mrs. Hardy said. "And frankly, we find it worth staying up for this late one, although in the last few weeks..."
She gestured.
I suppose you know as well as we do. Dangerfield is such a sick man.
They were all silent for a moment. Hardy said, To face the brutal fact, we haven't been able to pick him up at all the last day or so, except for a program of light opera that he has played over and over again automatically. So, he glanced around at the four of them.
That's why we were pinning so many hopes on this late transmission tonight.
To herself, Bonnie thought, There's so much business to conduct tomorrow, but he's right, we must stay up for this. We must know what is going on in the satellite. It's too important to us all. She felt sad. Walt Dangerfield, she thought, are you dying up there alone? Are you already dead and we don't know yet? Will the light opera music go on forever? She wondered. At least until the satellite at last falls back to the Earth, or drifts off into space and finally is attracted to the sun? I'll turn it on, Hardy said, inspecting his watch. He crossed the room to the radio, turned it on carefully. It takes it a long time to warm up, he apologized. I think there's a weak tube. We asked the West Berkeley Handyman's Association to inspect it, but they're so busy. They're too tied up, they said. I'd look at it myself, but... He shrugged ruefully. Last time I tried to fix it, I broke it worse. Stewart said, You're going to frighten Mr. Gill away.
No, Gill said. I understand. Radios are in the province of the Handys. It's the same up in West Marin.
To Bonnie, Mrs. Hardy said,
Stewart says you used to live here.
I worked at the radiation lab for a while, Bonnie said. And then I worked out at Livermore, also for the university. Of course, she hesitated. It's so changed, I wouldn't know Berkeley now. As we came through, I saw nothing I recognized except perhaps San Pablo Avenue itself. All the little shops, they look new.
They are, Dean Hardy said. Now static issued from the radio, and he bent attentively, his ear close to it. Generally, we pick up this late transmission at about 640 KC.
Excuse me.
He turned his back to them, intent on the radio.
Turn up the fat lamp, Gill said, so he can see better to tune it.
Bonnie did so, marveling that even here in the city they were still dependent on the primitive fat lamp. She had supposed that their electricity had long since been restored, at least on a partial basis. In some ways, she realized, they were actually behind West Marin, and in Bolinas.
Ah,
Mr. Hardy said, breaking into her thoughts. I think I've got him, and it's not light opera. His face glistened, beamed.
Oh, dear, Ella Hardy said. I pray to heaven he's better.
She clasped her hands together with anxiety. From the speaker, a friendly, informal, familiar voice boomed out loudly.
Hi there, all you night people down below. Who do you suppose this is, saying hello, hello, and hello?
Dangerfield laughed.
Yes, folks, I'm up and around on my 2 feet once more, and just twirling all these little old knobs and controls like crazy. Yes, sir.
His voice was warm, and around Bonnie the faces in the room relaxed, too, and smiled in company with the pleasure contained in the voice. The faces nodded, agreed.
You hear him?
Ella Hardy said.
Why, he's better. He is, you can tell. He's not just saying it, you can tell the difference.
Hooty hooty hoo, Dangerfield said. Well now, let us see. What news is there? You heard about that public enemy number one? That one-time physicist we all remember so well, our good buddy Dr. Bluthgeld, or should I say Dr. Bloodmoney. Anyhow, I guess you all know by now that dear Dr. Bloodmoney is no longer with us. Yes, that's right.
I heard a rumor about that, Mr. Hardy said excitedly. A peddler who hitched a balloon ride out of Marin County.
Shh,
Ella Hardy said, listening.
Yes, indeed, Dangerfield was saying. A certain party up in Northern California took care of Dr. B for good, and we owe a debt of sheer unadulterated gratitude to that certain little party, because, well, just consider this, folks. That party is a bit handicapped, and yet he was able to do what no one else could have done.
Now Dangerfield's voice was hard, unbending. It was a new sound which they had not heard from him ever before. They glanced at one another uneasily.
I'm talking about Hoppy Harrington, my friends. You don't know that name? You should. Because without Hoppy, not one of you would be alive.
Hardy, rubbing his chin and frowning, shot a questioning look at Ella.
This Hoppy Harrington, Dangerfield continued, mashed Dr. B from a good 4 miles away, and he was easy, very easy. You think it's impossible for someone to reach out and touch a man 4 miles off? That's mighty long arms, isn't it, folks? And mighty strong hands. Well, I'll tell you something even more remarkable.
The voice became confidential. It dropped to an intimate near whisper.
Hoppy has no arms, no hands at all.
And Dangerfield then was silent. Bonnie said quietly,
Andrew, it's him, isn't it?
Twisting around in his chair to face her, Gil said,
Yes, dear, I think so.
Who?
Stuart McConchie said. Now the voice from the radio resumed, more calmly this time, but also more bleakly. The voice had become chilly and stark.
There was an attempt made, it stated, to reward Mr. Harrington. It wasn't much. A few cigarettes and some bad whiskey, if you can call that a reward, and some empty phrases delivered by a cheap local politico. That was all. That was it for the man who saved us all. I guess they figured...
Ella Hardy said,
That is not Dangerfield.
To Gil and Bonnie, Mr. Hardy said,
Who is it? Say.
Bonnie said,
It's Hoppy.
Gil nodded.
Is he up there? Stuart said. In the satellite?
I don't know,
Bonnie said. But what did it matter?
He's got control of it. That's what's important.
And we thought by coming to Berkeley we would get away, she said to herself, that we would have left Hoppy.
I'm not surprised, she said. He's been preparing a long time. Everything else has been practiced for this.
But enough of that,
the voice from the radio declared, in a lighter tone now.
You'll hear more about the man who saved us all. I'll keep you posted from time to time. Old Walt isn't going to forget. Meanwhile, let's have a little music. What about a little authentic five-string banjo music, friends? Genuine, authentic U.S. American old-time folk music. Out on Penny's Farm, played by Pete Seeger, the greatest of the folk music men.
There was a pause, and then from the speaker came the sound of a full symphony orchestra. Thoughtfully, Bonnie said,
Hoppy doesn't have it down quite right. There are a few circuits left he hasn't got control of.
The symphony orchestra abruptly ceased. Silence obtained again, and then something spilled out at the incorrect speed. It squeaked frantically and was chopped off. In spite of herself, Bonnie smiled. At last, belatedly, there came the sound of the five-string banjo. Hard times in the country, out on Penny's farm. It was a folksy tenor voice twanging away, along with the banjo. The people in the room sat listening, obeying out of long habit. The music emanated from the radio, and for 7 years they had depended on this. They had learned this, and it had become a part of their physical bodies, this response. And yet, Bonnie felt the shame and despair around her. No one in the room fully understood what had happened. She herself felt only a numbed confusion. They had Dangerfield back, and yet they did not. They had the outer form, the appearance. But was it really, in essence? It was some labored apparition, like a ghost. It was not alive, not viable. It went through the motions, but it was empty and dead. It had a peculiar, preserved quality, as if somehow the cold, the loneliness, had combined to form around the man in the satellite a new shell, a case which fitted over the living substance and snuffed it out. The killing, the slow destruction of Dangerfield, Bonnie thought, was deliberate, and it came not from space, not from beyond, but from below, from the familiar landscape. Dangerfield had not died from the years of isolation. He had been stricken by careful instruments issuing up from the very world which he struggled to contact. If he could have cut himself off from us, she thought, he would be alive now. At the very moment he listened to us, received us, he was being killed, and did not guess. He does not guess even now, she decided. It probably baffles him, if he is capable of perception at this point, capable of any form of awareness.
"This is terrible," Gil was saying in a monotone. "Terrible," Bonnie agreed. "But inevitable. He was too vulnerable up there. If Hoppy hadn't done it, someone else would have, one day."
"What'll we do?" Mr. Hardy said.
"If you folks are so sure of this, we better..."
"Oh," Bonnie said,
"we're sure. There's no doubt. You think we ought to form a delegation and call on Hoppy again? Ask him to stop? I wonder what he'd say."
I wonder, she thought, how near we would get to that familiar little house before we were demolished. Perhaps we are too close even now, right here in this room. Not for the world, she thought, would I go any nearer. I think, in fact, I will move farther on. I will get Andrew Gill to go with me, and if not him, then Stuart. If not Stuart, then someone. I will keep going. I will not stay in one place, and maybe I will be safe from Hoppy. I don't care about the others at this point, because I am too scared. I only care about myself.
"Andy," she said to Gil, "listen, I want to go."
"Out of Berkeley, you mean?"
"Yes," she nodded. "Down the coast to Los Angeles. I know we could make it. We'd get there, and we'd be okay there. I know it."
Gil said,
"I can't go, dear. I have to return to West Marin. I have my business. I can't give it up."
Appalled, she said,
"You'd go back to West Marin?"
"Yes, why not?
We can't give up just because Hoppy has done this. That's not reasonable to ask of us. Even Hoppy isn't asking that." "But he will," she said. "He'll ask everything in time. I know it. I can foresee it."
"Then we'll wait," Gil said.
"Until then. Meanwhile, let's do our jobs."
To Hardy and Stuart McConchie, he said,
"I'm going to turn in, because, Christ, we have plenty to discuss tomorrow."
He rose to his feet.
"Things may work themselves out. We mustn't despair."
He whacked Stuart on the back.
"Right?"
Stuart said, "I hid once in the sidewalk. Do I have to do that again?" He looked around at the rest of them, seeking an answer.
"Yes,"
Bonnie said.
"Then I will," he said. "But I came up out of the sidewalk. I didn't stay there. And I'll come up again."
He too rose.
"Gil, you can stay with me in my place. Bonnie, you can stay with the Hardys."
"Yes,"
Ella Hardy said, stirring.
"We have plenty of room for you, Mrs. Keller, until we can find a more permanent arrangement."
"Good,"
Bonnie said automatically.
"That's swell."
She rubbed her eyes. A good night's sleep, she thought. It would help. And then what? We will just have to see. If, she thought, we are alive tomorrow. To her, Gil said suddenly,
"Bonnie, do you find this hard to believe about Hoppy? Or do you find it easy?
Do you know him that well? Do you understand him?"
"I think," she said, "it's very ambitious of him. But it's what we should have expected. Now he has reached out farther than any of us. As he says, he's now got long, long arms. He's compensated beautifully. You have to admire him."
"Yes," Gil admitted. "I do. Very much."
"If I only thought this would satisfy him," she said, "I wouldn't be so afraid."
"The man I feel sorry for," Gil said, "is Dangerfield. Having to lie there passively, sick as he is, and just listen." She nodded, but she refused to imagine it. She could not bear to. Hurrying down the path in her robe and slippers, Edie Keller groped her way toward Hoppy Harrington's house.
"Hurry," Bill said from within her. "He knows about us, they're telling me. They say we're in danger. If we can get close enough to him, I can do an imitation of someone dead that'll scare him, because he's afraid of dead people. Mr. Blaine says that's because to him, the dead are like fathers, lots of fathers, and..."
"Be quiet," Edie said. "Let me think."
In the darkness, she had gotten mixed up. She could not find the path through the oak forest now, and she halted, breathing deeply, trying to orient herself by the dull light of the partial moon overhead. It's to the right, she thought, down the hill. I must not fall. He'd hear the noise. He can hear a long way, almost everything. Step by step she descended, holding her breath.
I've got a good imitation ready,
Bill was mumbling. He would not be quiet.
It's like this. When I get near him, I switch with someone dead. And you won't like that because it's sort of squishy. But it's just for a few minutes, and then they can talk to him direct from inside you. Is that okay? Because once he hears...
It's okay, she said. Just for a little while.
Well, then you know what they say? They say...
We have been taught a terrible lesson for our folly. This is God's way of making us see.
And you know what that is? That's the minister who used to make sermons when Hoppy was a baby and got carried on his dad's back to church. He'll remember that, even though it was years and years ago. It was the most awful moment in his life. You know why? Because that minister, he was making everybody in the church look at Hoppy, and that was wrong, and Hoppy's father never went back after that. But that's a lot of the reason why Hoppy is like he is today, because of that minister. So he's really terrified of that minister, and when he hears his voice again...
Shut up!
Edie said desperately. They were now above Hoppy's house. She saw the lights below.
Please, Bill, please!
But I have to explain to you,
Bill went on,
when I...
He stopped. Inside her there was nothing. She was empty.
Bill?
She said. He had gone. Before her eyes, in the dull moonlight, something she had never seen before bobbed. It rose, jiggled, its long pale hair streaming behind it like a tail. It rose until it hung directly before her face. It had tiny, dead eyes and a gaping mouth. It was nothing but a little hard, round head like a baseball. From its mouth came a squeak, and then it fluttered upward once more, released. She watched as it gained more and more height, rising above the trees in a swimming motion, ascending in the unfamiliar atmosphere which it had never known before.
Bill,
she said,
he took you out of me. He put you outside.
And you are leaving, she realized. Hoppy is making you go.
Come back,
she said. But it didn't matter, because he could not live outside of her. She knew that. Dr. Stockstill had said that. He could not be born, and Hoppy had heard him and made him born, knowing that he would die. You won't get to do your imitation, she realized. I told you to be quiet, and you wouldn't. Straining, she saw, or thought she saw, the hard little object with the streamers of hair now above her, and then it disappeared silently. She was alone. Why go on now? It was over. She turned, walked back up the hillside, her head lowered, eyes shut, feeling her way back to her house, her bed. Inside she felt raw, she felt the tearing loose. If you only could have been quiet, she thought, he would not have heard you. I told you so. She plodded on back. Floating in the atmosphere, Bill Keller saw a little, heard a little, felt the trees and the animals alive and moving among them. He felt the pressure at work on him, lifting him, but he remembered his imitation, and he said it. His voice came out tiny in the cold air. Then his ears picked it up, and he exclaimed,
"We have been taught a terrible lesson for our folly,"
he squeaked, and his voice echoed in his ears, delighting him. The pressure on him let go. He bobbed up, swimming happily, and then he dove. Down and down he went, and just before he touched the ground he went sideways, until, guided by the living presence within, he hung suspended above Hoppy Harrington's antenna and house.
"This is God's way,"
he shouted in his thin, tiny voice.
"We can see that it is time to call a halt to high-altitude nuclear testing. I want all of you to write letters to President Johnson."
He did not know who President Johnson was. A living person, perhaps. He looked around for him, but he did not see him. He saw oak forests of animals. He saw a bird with noiseless wings that drifted, huge-beaked, eyes staring. Bill squeaked in fright as the noiseless, brown-feathered bird glided his way. The bird made a dreadful sound of greed and the desire to rend.
"All of you,"
Bill cried, fleeing through the dark, chill air.
"You must write letters in protest."
The glittering eyes of the bird followed behind him as he and it glided above the trees in the dim moonlight. The owl reached him and crunched him in a single instant.